Hello and welcome to this podcast of the March meeting of the IFRS Interpretations Committee. My name is Bob Garnett and I chair the committee, and I'm joined by Michael Stewart, who's the ISB's Director of Implementation Activities. We've had a fairly full agenda this time, and we'd just like to take a selection of the topics that we covered at this meeting. First of all, we turn to our favourite topic of the moment, the interpretation and development dealing with accounting for production phase stripping costs in the mining industry. At the previous meeting, we had a report back of the comment letters that had been submitted, and since then the staff has been undertaking some further outreach with some of these commentators to gain a better understanding of the reasons for some of the comments, the concerns, and also the solutions to them. We think at this meeting we've made some significant progress that will help to address some of the concerns that we were being perhaps overly prescriptive in the development of our interpretation. But the essence of it is that it's focused, and we're clearly now expanding on the principles to state that the requirement for the recognition of an asset, consistent with the framework and also consistent with IAS 16, which we believe is a governing standard on these items, is that there should be a benefit reflected by an expected inflow of cash or other assets in the future, that we can identify the costs that relate to that. And also we need to clarify that the benefits that would be created in the future are benefits that can be identified by reference to the ore body. In most mining organisations, this information should be contained within the mining plan and the detailed subset. We need to now consider how this principle will be expressed in words so that it's clear and understandable, not to result in a significant increase in administrative burden for the preparers of mining financial statements, but to assist them in understanding in those circumstances when they would consider that the cost of production stripping are merely a cost of producing inventory in the period, and where there is a significant part of those costs that relates to the development of the ore body with a view to accessing the ore in a future period. Now, Michael, we decided that we would take out some of the terms that we'd used before, like a stripping campaign, and that we wouldn't talk about being aggressive or routine. Do you have any comments on how you think people should be looking at this to implement it going forward?
Yes, I think the approach that we're likely to take on this now is really getting back to the concepts that we have in IAS 16 around componentization, and really identifying the component of the ore that is going to benefit from the stripping activity, and associate the work that's been done, the benefit with that particular section of the ore. The stripping campaign had looked as if it was going to be a useful approach, because it was a way of distinguishing some significant change in the nature of the work that was, or the change in the nature of the benefits that were being realised through the stripping activity. But I think maybe if we are able to focus more on the principles and talk about identifying significant benefits associated with the future access, that is a way in which we can avoid having to use or create a definition that wasn't being really widespreadly used within the industry.
Now, one of the questions, of course, that many commentators had raised with us is that they have a very simple way of accounting for these costs at the moment by using their mine plan and estimating the remaining life of mine stripping ratio, and using that as a mathematical tool to say that if the amount of waste that is lifted is actually greater than the life of mine strip ratio, then they defer a proportion of cost based on that. It seems a very simple and easy way to implement and is widely used in the industry. Do you think that's a procedure that will be continued going forward?
The problem with the life of mine stripping ratio, there's a couple of problems as I see it. One is there's a very sort of mechanical approach inherent in it. And I think what we would like to see coming out of this interpretation is a focus on an assessment by management of the benefit that is created. So identifying the benefit and that being the basis on which costs are capitalized as part of a long-term asset, rather than by reference to a sort of an average ratio. The other aspect which I think will likely change is the unit of account almost. It's looking at the fact that, as I said before, using the componentization approach that we have in 16 and linking the benefit that is achieved through the stripping activity to that component of the ore that is the access to it has been improved by that particular stripping activity, and linking that through both in terms of the capitalization of the cost and also the subsequent amortization of those costs. And both of those aspects are different from the life of mine stripping approach. So I think there's going to need to be some change there. There could be some aspects of the application of the interpretation that can make use of sort of standard costing type approaches. So we can still look at, well, what is the cost that we expect to be incurring in order to remove ore, and that can still form part of the basis of the capitalization. But I think it will be moving away from the life of mine stripping ratio approach.
Oh, well, that's comforting to know that we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as it were, that we're not requiring people to develop very sophisticated new administrative systems to track this, requiring people to use their judgment in accounting issues seems to be a sensible approach forward and entirely consistent with principle-based financial reporting standards. Let's move on now to another item that we discussed, and strictly this is not an interpretive issue, but it was one that first came to the committee because of diversity that was developing in practice, where an entity had written, typically a parent had written, put options to its non-controlling shareholders so that they could place their shares back, sometimes at a fixed price, sometimes at whatever the market price was, or the fair value at some time in the future, or sometimes even on a formula basis. And many people have commented that they were getting some, I think you'd call it, counterintuitive volatility going through in the profit and loss statement as a result of having written these options, which really were options that were written together with another equity participant. Now, we took this matter back up to the board and described to the board what the issue was. But in the workload and the pressures that they're under at the moment, they felt actually that the Interpretations Committee was the body that had the current knowledge and expertise to recommend an approach that would meet the needs of constituents, meet the needs of the users of financial statements, and actually improve financial reporting. Do you think we've been able to achieve that at this meeting?
I think we've made very good progress at this meeting. I mean, the balance here, of course, is to balance the need for addressing this issue, which, you know, we've been told there is diversity in practice and that these are instruments that do cause some significant charges or credits in the income statement, and balancing the need to address that with the fact that the board does still have on its agenda, even if it's not actively working on it right now, the financial instruments with characteristics of equity project, so the liability equity project, which will be considering the broader issues in that, and obviously concerns that we need to be responsive to the needs of constituents right now, with not wanting to try and preempt the board's discussions on the FICE project. And so, yes, the board's brief to the Interpretations Committee was very much, well, is there a narrow scope solution to this issue that the committee could recommend to the board that might be able to address the most concerning aspects of the issue? Can't deal with all of the different issues with these types of instruments. So what we've been able to do this time is to look at a proposal for the board that would address the issue for a very limited scope of instruments. So these are standalone put options, so not things that are embedded in other instruments, and just those that are held or accounted for in the consolidated financial statements as well. And recommend that by a few relatively small changes to the standards, be able to change the accounting of these instruments from a gross liability basis, which was the cause of a lot of the, as you mentioned, the counterintuitive results, to being a net fair value type measurement, the same as we use for most other derivatives, and then requiring that accounting to be used. And I think, you know, it looks as if, and so the committee were in agreement, that this looks as if this solution could work. And so the next step will be to recommend the changes to the board. And so the board, perhaps next month, we can get them to look at this and give their views on whether they think this can be implemented. And, you know, if we are able to make this change, it will address that, particularly that counterintuitive aspect. It won't eliminate volatility from the income statement, because there will still be, if we change the measurement basis, there will be those put options that will have a fixed price, which, although they've got a fixed exercise price, they will have a changeable fair value. So there will be changes in the measurement of those instruments now, which there didn't used to be. But the message that I think we heard was that people were less concerned about that because there was good, relevant information value in the changes of the fair values of those instruments, that actually reflecting that change in the financial statements would actually be useful for users of the financial statements.
All right, so sometimes volatility is actually intuitive then, and volatility that's taking place reflecting the underlying economics is useful information for investors, and perhaps also salutary for the preparers to realise what they've committed to and what the effect of that is on other shareholders. If we turn now to one of the items, and we decided at the previous meeting, I think that we would bring this onto our agenda, a question that had been raised about acquisitions of property, plant and equipment, or of, in some cases, intangible assets, possibly even inventory, where the pricing for it was contingent on a subsequent event or some other circumstance, and whether or not, in fact, in terms of IAS 16, the cost of an item acquired included in some measure this contingent pricing. I suppose rather than looking at it broadly, we've tried to focus on the PP&E items. The IAS 16 is fairly clear that all the costs of acquisition should be included in bringing the asset into its location and condition ready for its intended use. That's fine, of course, until IFRS 3 came on the scene and said, but contingent consideration in a business combination is now going to be accounted for at fair value with subsequent changes through profit and loss. IFRS 3, of course, is recognising most of assets and liabilities at their fair values. So it's a different underlying measurement concept from IAS 16. And so people don't have anything to analogise to now. But many people before were using this analogy to not recognise the liability for the contingency until they knew what the outcome was. Perhaps a crude way of expressing, until they could measure it reliably. But of course we know now that people are much more sophisticated in valuing things and could value it at an earlier stage. Now, this is only the first meeting at which the committee's been discussing the technical solutions to this. So what have they concluded on the initial recognition?
Well, on the initial recognition, there did seem to be a coalescing of views among the committee members that we've got, I think, a few pieces of literature that can help us with this. As you said, the analogy to IFRS 3 was concerning some, but I think we've got two other pieces of literature that can be helpful and, in fact, I think are consistent with one another. First of all, of course, is I-16 itself, which is the standard that tells us how to account for property, plant and equipment. And we've been focusing very much on the cost model in that standard. And that talks about recording an asset at its cost, and the cost being the fair value of the consideration given, including any other sort of consideration that or obligations that are taken on. So there is a notion there that the cost of an asset would include the fair value of any future consideration that will be transferred in the future. In addition to that, the analysis that we presented to the committee identified that what we're talking about is a contract to purchase an asset and to pay over some consideration. So the contractual nature of this obligation or potential obligation to pay cash in the future means that it fits within the definition of a financial instrument, specifically a financial liability within IAS 32 and IAS 39. And IAS 39 requires that financial instruments and certainly financial liabilities are initially recorded at fair value. So again, there's that symmetry there between the description of cost and the components of cost within I-16 and the initial recognition of a liability under IAS 39, both of which at fair value. Now, the concern that, or the argument that I think some had made in the past, and certainly we'd included in the paper, was concerning not being able to assess, or there perhaps not being an obligation to pay until the contingent event occurs. I think the way that we might look at it under IAS 39 is that the contract itself creates the obligation, and then the contingent event confirms or specifies how much should be paid. So if we were to take the approach for initial recognition that we record the asset at the cost of the consideration we've given on the day of purchase plus the fair value of what we've contractually agreed to give in the future, then that would establish the initial measurement of the asset, which would include this contingent consideration at its fair value at the date of purchase, plus a corresponding liability for that future payment.
All right. We seem to be making some reasonable progress on there, and hopefully at the next meeting we'll be able to consider ways in which either under existing IFRS or under perhaps some amendments that we might propose to recognise changes in this obligation appropriate to whatever its circumstances are, either part of the cost of the asset or as a financing or speculative perhaps even nature. But we understand, of course, that the reason contingent pricing often comes into being is sometimes because of financing concerns and sometimes because it's just too difficult to agree on a fixed price, and people want to wait and see just what happens at the end of the day. Well, we don't have to wait too much longer to know what that is, so we'll talk about that a little bit more at the next meeting. Now, the other issues that were on our agenda, perhaps there's one that we need to make a reference to, because some concern had been expressed in some parts of the world that there were local gap interpretations. Local gap interpretations, in fact, of an interpretation of IFRIC 15 dealing with real estate and the construction of real estate and how that should be accounted for. We developed that interpretation a couple of years ago and said quite clearly that If you're developing a construction contract that meets particular requirements, then you're under IS 11. If it's not that, you're under IS 18. It's nice and easy under IFRS. You've only got two standards to look at for revenue at the moment. It'll be even easier in the future when the board is finished in the middle of the year. It's new revenue recognition standard, but we have to wait for that. But the concern then was expressed for the delivery of goods as to whether or not there was a continuous transfer of the risks and rewards related to that. And some national standard setters seem to have taken a view that they want to require continuous transfer in all circumstances. And others are expressing a view that perhaps this blanket rule is inconsistent with the requirement to exercise judgment. So the request came back to the committee. And we don't normally give implementation guidance, and I'm not aware of any circumstance when we've given implementation guidance specific to an individual country or jurisdiction interpreting their specific laws. We simply can't do that. These are international standards. So what are we going to do to resolve this one, Michael?
Well, yes, there was obviously a fair bit of discussion about this at this committee meeting, and IFRIC 15 obviously focuses on the transfer of control, and the question was all about circumstances in which there is a continuous transfer of control. And some of the particular concerns that were submitted, detailed fact patterns that described situations in particular jurisdictions. And certainly a number of the committee members were not wanting to issue further guidance in this area. They felt that in order to do so, it would end up in being implementation guidance. There is a principle in IFRIC 15, and IFRIC 15 also specifies the requirement for judgment to be applied in applying that principle. And so the committee members really did feel that to do anything more would be in the form of implementation guidance, which we typically don't do. So the tentative decision was not to take this onto the agenda, not to issue further guidance. We will be bringing back the issue, though, to the next meeting to really agree the what we want to say in our agenda decision. Now, our agenda decision obviously initially will be tentative, but we'll set out the committee's views on the particular issue, particular question that had been submitted, and explain why we are not going to take that onto our agenda. And if there is a way in which we can nevertheless be helpful in pointing out the particular aspects of IFRIC 15 which we think should be focused on in this situation, then we'd be able to do that. But we can also highlight the reasons as to why we won't be taking that onto the agenda. But that'll be something that the committee will agree next time, and then go through the process of publishing its tentative agenda decision, inviting comments on that, and then finalising it at the July meeting.
And of course, by the time we get around there, then we're expecting that the board would have completed its work on the revenue recognition project. And so we will have that as a basis to compare and contrast. And as we had representatives from the board at our meeting this time, from the staff and the board members themselves, I think when we had that discussion, they were aware of this particular concern. And we'll no doubt take steps to ensure that the new standard is absolutely clear on this, and that there is then no doubt on how it will be applied in practice. All right. Well, Michael, I think that is probably as much as we should cover in this particular podcast. You and I, of course, know after having 2 days of meetings, there is so much more we can say, but we'll save that until another time. If you would refer to the IFRIC update, which will be published during the course of the next few days following this meeting, that is the official record of what was discussed and what was either decided or tentatively decided at the meeting. It's also going to be available as a webcast archived under the IFRIC projects. You should also note that the next meeting we'll be holding will be a two-day meeting on the 5th and 6th of May. Other than that, it remains for me to say that we have a general disclaimer that the views that Michael and I have expressed are our personal views, not necessarily those of the ISB or of the committee. But we enjoyed talking to you again and look forward to tuning in next time.